Welcome to the latest episode of The Grower and The Economist. I'm Michelle Klieger, The Economist.
And I'm Peter Kanjoyan, The Grower.
Each week, we team up to tackle the biggest challenges facing small and medium-sized growers. We're one part grower and one part economist, just like your business. Welcome to this episode of The Grower and The Economist. Today, Peter and I are joined by Charles Smith and Victoria Holden of Emeo. And Charles and I had the opportunity to meet in San Francisco last November, I believe, right before Thanksgiving, where he was presenting at the ag tech part of Plug and Play, and I was on one of the panels. So we had an opportunity to chat for a few minutes afterward, realized that both of our businesses are located in New England, and wanted to get to know you and Victoria and your company a little bit more. So thank you so much for joining us and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having us. We're really excited to be here. We really enjoy this podcast. I think that you both share a lot of great knowledge and perspective, and we're really happy to be part of the conversation today.
Can you, each of you, give us a brief 30-second background on career paths, education, all that?
Sure, absolutely. And if you don't mind, maybe we can kind of start with Emeo and then go into kind of our personal journeys as well. At Emeo, we are a regenerative ag biotech company. We develop microbial inoculants that replace chemical inputs in agriculture. And the way that we got started was really in recognizing the volume of organic matter that is wasted every year and the environmental and economic consequences of that. As you both probably know, about a third of food produced globally ends up being wasted. And when that food ends up in landfills or in settings where it is degrading under unideal conditions, it typically produces methane, which is an extremely potent greenhouse gas. And as I said before, not only is that a major environmental issue, it's also a big economic problem and also an opportunity. There's a lot of value that remains in that leftover organic matter. We sort of go out of our way not to say organic waste or plant waste because we think there's no such thing as plant waste. And so as I was sort of digging into that challenge, I came to understand that microorganisms are really the engine in nature that turns leftover organic matter back into nutrients for, you know, continued growing and kind of the next cycle of life. And I was very fortunate to connect with Victoria Holden, who is a brilliant PhD microbiologist and my co-founder, who was able to turn this idea into a reality for our company. And Victoria, maybe if you want to tell a little bit, take it from there in terms of the journey.
Yeah, so I had a pretty standard academic journey up until I met Charles, I'd say. I earned my PhD from the University of Michigan in microbiology and immunology. And then I went to Dartmouth where I did my postdoc research. In both of those places, I was really interested in studying the interaction between microbes and their environment. So at Michigan and Dartmouth, the environment in question was the lung. But as I was beginning to think about my next career step, I was really interested in finding a way that I could use my knowledge to more rapidly help the environment in the world. Of course, academic research is incredibly important, but it takes a long time to become something, and I wanted to have an impact faster. So as I was starting to look around, I got really fortunate and was introduced to Charles through a mutual friend, and started to consult with him and develop these ideas for what these microbes could be. And after a few months of consulting, I said, "Hey, Charles, can I come work with you full time?" And I was really nervous for that conversation, but he was, of course, like, "Are you kidding me?" Absolutely.
Ch- Charles, I'm guessing that you might have studied business in some shape or form.
Yes, that's right. I went to Dartmouth College for undergrad, and I studied history modified with economics was my major, and I was a psychology minor. So sort of a lot of mixed things there, but with a lot of interesting overlap. Started my career in finance, was at Morgan Stanley for a few years, which was a great opportunity to learn a lot, develop, you know, analytical skills, move from Morgan Stanley to some technology startups in New York City. As I was in a financial role, I came to realize that I was really more interested in sort of the technological innovations taking place, what sort of companies were making those happen, the big industry trends. And so I was fortunate to get a great job at a very fast growing technology startup in New York. And that gave me a great opportunity to learn a lot about what it takes to grow a business, to grow customer relationships, really effective teams. Also, you know, develop some great relationships and mentorships there, which continue to be part of our team at now IMEO. So that was sort of my path. Goes back to what I was saying before. I was thinking about challenges that I felt I could really, you know, be excited to dedicate my career towards, and environmental challenges were very high on that list for me. So that kind of brings us back to where I started with thinking about, you know, the volume of food that's wasted and you know, solutions to that.
Well, a couple of two really interesting observations. One, it seems that the two of you, Charles and Victoria, you've teamed up identically as Michelle and I have teamed up, with one on the business economics side and the other on the science research side. So I find that really intriguing. And then secondly, Charles, to your point of crop waste, or what we're calling it, Michelle, how many episodes have we dedicated to crop shrinkage, crop loss, and how, as a grower, it affects my profitability? And not only standalone episodes, but it is a recurring theme in every other or every third episode. So IMEO has its finger on the pulse here. And I would guess, I'm going to make this statement and let you guys start running. But if I, as a grower, control or eliminate my crop loss, that kind of puts IMEO out of business. But I think in reality, it's not an achievable goal. So I think the two of us working together, both sides come to this maximizing profitability for the grower. So that's it for my introductory comments. Michelle, please direct them and continue.
Well, I guess we talk about shrinkage a lot and how that impacts the business and how losing one plant is the profit of four others. But I'm sort of thinking about your greenhouse at the end of the summer when you have these giant, healthy tomato plants. What happens to those? And that seems like really good material to put into the IMEO system.
That's exactly what we're focused on. And to your point, Peter, you know, crop loss does happen, and you know, our products can be used to kind of recapture nutrients from there. But really what we are most oriented around is sort of the part of the plant that is not sold. And of course, many crops that are grown commercially are annual crops, in which, you know, a large part of the plant is cut down and harvested. And if you think about that stock, there is a ton of nutrient potential there. And just because it's not part of, you know, what you're selling to your customers doesn't mean it's not something that can bring a lot of value to your business. Mm-hmm. And one of the sort of foundational ideas around our technology, particularly our product Regen, which is the one that we've developed to recycle leftover plant matter, is this idea that a lot of, as I said, a lot of plants we cultivate commercially are annuals, meaning that they have a set lifestyle at the end of that, life cycle. At the end of their life cycle, they die, and left to their own devices in nature, many of them would decompose, release their seeds, and the next generation could use the previous as a nutrient source. So we've developed our products to make that happen extremely quickly and efficiently, and with very low kind of maintenance requirements for growers such that it's more efficient, accessible, and creates as much nutrient value as possible.
That's really interesting. Charles, I think as my generation approaches retirement, during my career, we've seen the evolution where we're using biomass or some of this plant waste as fuel to heat the greenhouse. And it seems that as we learn from microbiologists such as Victoria, we learn more and understand nature rather than just burn it for fuel. Let's learn more. Let's understand more about Mother Nature and turn this back into regeneration of nutrients. I think it's all a fascinating curve. If I go back to my father's generation, he told stories of using DDT in the fields. And my point looking back at that, and I try not to use the word foolish, but it was just ignorance and not in a derogatory way. We didn't know any better. So when we started burning biomass 20 or 30 years ago, we didn't know any better. We didn't, but now we learn so much more, right? It's exciting.
Yeah.
Totally agree. And what I'd add to that is there weren't always a lot of tools available to kind of go along with that knowledge. Farmers have generally relied on a lot of chemical inputs, and many of those chemical inputs have been the most effective options available. But now that we are understanding so much more about the interactions between plants and, you know, their microbiome, all the microbiology taking place in the soil within the plant, we have more ability to offer more tools to growers.
Victoria, could I ask a question of you, a basic question? We're talking about regenerative agriculture. Would you offer your definition of what regenerative means?
Absolutely. To me, regenerative agriculture really refers to giving back to nature what you're taking from it. And so that is what our microbes are there to do. They are there to break down the plant and give those nutrients back to the soil. The soil is so incredibly important, and microbes are such a major part of the soil that trying to encourage those symbiotic relationships are kind of the underpinning of regenerative agriculture. To me, of course, I'm a microbiologist, so I'm biased.
And so I was looking on your website before, and it looks like there's all different sizes. So is this a tool that makes sense for everyone from the home gardener to a commercial operation, or is there a target or like an expertise level that is needed?
So from our perspective, it does make sense sort of across, you know, all sorts of different scale ranges, from home growers to, you know, large scale commercial operations. And we really try to make our products as simple to use as possible. There is, I'm a big believer that, you know, your product is only as effective as somebody's ability to use it effectively. And so kind of the more straightforward those applications can be, the better from my perspective. We have mostly focused on commercial operations up to this point. The technology itself, the products themselves are very much applicable to gardens or fields of any size.
That's a good question, Michelle, and a really good point. We often talk about what our target is, you know, large farmer, small farmer, large greenhouse operator, et cetera. And when we get to, and Michelle's heard me, one of my favorite isms is, and Victoria, as I get older, it becomes more true, and that is a plant is a plant is a plant. And plant physiology is plant physiology. So in this regard, this vein of questioning, you know, if we understand nature to this extent, it doesn't matter whether it's Michelle in her backyard vegetable garden or me in a commercial greenhouse or a really large top 100 greenhouse operation in the country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've focused in on a few plant types. And in particular, we first started working on hemp and cannabis just because there are some there are many known challenges around working with it. It's a really difficult to degrade plant because it's so woody due to a molecule called lignin. There's also not a lot of research that's been done on hemp and cannabis due to it being illegal to grow up until 2014. And that was just the way that we decided to focus our research and product development to have, you know, a pinpoint focus. But as we've gotten great results around working with hemp and cannabis, we've started to step into more home and gardener types of plants, like tomatoes, and then some more commercially grown plants as well, like rye and corn. So like you said, a plant is a plant is a plant.
That's so interesting. I think one of the things that came to mind when you mentioned the woodiness of the hemp, which is, or cannabis, which is often, you know, a big part of the discussion right now on hemp and its other usage, it makes me think of Johnny's and how they say that they do their trialing in Maine because the conditions are the hardest, right? It's cold and so forth. And so if the plants do well there, then they, you know, expect them to do well in other places. And obviously that has limitations depending on what your climate is. But it feels a little bit like if we're trying to break down material, something that's woody and has this lignin in it would be the hardest. And so like once you get your proof of concept there and some success there, that moving to other plants seems like it makes sense. And so that also makes sense in my mind on a path to take.
Totally agree. We're big believers in kind of going right after the big challenges right away.
Yeah, that's been the through line in all of the research that I do. I only like to solve problems when they're really hard. So,
well said. Okay, take another step. What is the product? How is the grower using it? What is it allowing the grower to experience?
Well, we have two main products, so I'll talk first about Regen. Regen is a consortium of microbes that is designed to degrade plant material and return the nutrients back to the soil for the next crop cycle. We think of it as having three functional groups. The first are the lignin degrading microbes that release the nutrients from the plant. And then we also have acid producers and plant microbe symbionts that help continue that bioavailable nutrient process. Our second product is Root. So that is a product that helps, it's a natural alternative to synthetic hormones, and it helps form those symbiotic relationships with the plant so that they can develop stronger roots, which of course are incredibly important to plant development.
Root can be used in a variety of ways. One is actually in the propagation method of taking cuttings from mature plants or cloning. So those cuts can be dipped directly into Root, which is available in liquid and gel forms and is very effective in helping the plant to develop roots more quickly and more consistently. It can also be watered in, particularly around transplant time or really any time that you're looking for the to kind of supercharge the plant's microbiome and create those symbiotic relationships that can lead to better root development. Regen, on the other hand, also can be used in sort of a variety of ways for plants that are typically, you know, harvested and residuals that are piled up. Regen can be applied to that pile, and it's a very fast degradation process. So about a 3 to 5 week timeline between applying it to those residuals and having something usable as a nutrient source. Or it can also be applied in the fields, particularly if residuals have been left in the fields. And that's part of our, you know, framework in terms of trying to make things as easy to implement as possible. We want Regen to be applied wherever the residuals are.
Oh, that's cool. So the farmer, the grower, is managing the process. So, Victoria, as a scientist, I have some non-scientific favorites. And when you mentioned roots and their importance, In my garden center days, when we'd have grammar school, busloads of kids coming, the one thing I tried to teach them during their tour was happy roots make happy shoots. and it's so applicable to commercial growers. I changed the words a little bit, but it's still the same principle. So, Charles, am I understanding correctly, as someone that's, you know, just trying to wrap my arms around on what IMEO is doing, can I categorize this as a compost accelerant?
You could call regen a compost accelerant. And certainly the end goals with composting are quite similar, right? Trying to take these residuals and turn them into something that's valuable as a nutrient source. Sort of the differences I would highlight with compost, and, you know, first of all, let me be clear, we think compost is wonderful and is an incredibly powerful tool, and studying compost was very much part of how we, you know, arrived at the consortium that is regen. But with compost, you're essentially trying to invite the microbial communities that actually do the work of breaking down the organic matter. Ultimately, it is microbes doing the work. But with compost, you are balancing your carbon and nitrogen inputs, maintaining certain moisture levels, turning the pile, again, in an effort to invite those microbes, but in a way that's somewhat indirect. Our approach with regen is to directly introduce the microbes that we know to be most effective in breaking down that organic matter as quickly as possible and with the most bioavailable nutrients as an output. So the other kind of element that I'd mention with that, what Victoria referenced before, the functional group that we have of acid-producing microbes, those are significant as well in making the process as easy as possible to implement, because through that set of microbes, we also introduce some anaerobic microbes, meaning that we're sort of eliminating one of the most common and significant challenges with traditional thermophilic composts of piles going anaerobic, right? That part of why you have to maintain a compost pile so consistently is because you need to make sure that you're stacking the environment in the favor of the aerobic microbes that you're trying to invite. By including some anaerobic microbes as well, kind of cover our bases, whether it's an oxygen-rich or an oxygen-poor environment. And that is sort of building in some of the tenets of bokashi or anaerobic fermentation, if you're familiar with those sorts of methodologies.
All right, so I think I was guilty a moment ago of overgeneralizing and labeling or trying to connect composting with what you're doing with regen. So my apology there. I understand it better now. And let's keep things separate.
I'm guessing they get it a lot because it was on their frequently asked questions. So I have a feeling that if that was the first thing that jumped to your mind, Peter, that most of our listeners are going to be in the same boat. And so it's a Absolutely. Really good opportunity mm-hmm. to let Charles clarify and make sure that, you know, we're all understanding, because it's a really interesting and novel product.
Yeah, the reality of it is that it is really novel. And so that has been a fun challenge to work with as we move forward.
So now, guys, take me that one step further. What's the end process? What are we doing with whatever we end up with? Are we ending up with some type of a slurry that's then a, you know, comparable, quote unquote, a tea? Or
yeah, it kind of looks more like a mulch at the end, I would say. Part of the process is curing the residuals with soil or cocoa core. So at the end, it tends to look more like a mulch. Some growers plant directly into it. Some growers use it as a top dressing for their plants. It's not a very foreign looking, I would say.
And Victoria, having spent most of my career in ornamentals with garden center, flowers, bedding plants, we are continually researching new inputs. Can this product then be incorporated into a potting mix for potted container production?
Absolutely. It absolutely can. And I think oftentimes that's where it works the best, if you mix it in with some perlite and other inputs as well. It's a really nice and rich growing medium.
Charles, have you had any interest expressed by some of the soil mix manufacturers to use the process? I mean, more than one of them are composting as, and they're having a little trouble with consistency and whatnot, but they're looking at wood chips, we're looking at wood fiber, we're looking at peat substitutes, we're looking at replacements for chemical slow release fertilizer inputs.
Yeah, it's a great question, Peter, and we have gotten some of that interest from, you know, large scale composters and or kind of soil companies. Something that is, and we're starting to explore that a bit more, but one of the reasons that we have been so oriented around working directly with growers is it's extremely important to us that we are providing our customers with products that are extremely viable, active, and going to create the most value for them. Our products are living, and so that means we have to make sure they're alive. And so by working directly with farmers, we have ensured that we can deliver the microbes in an extremely active, ready-to-use form when the growers are ready to use them. Now, we are just starting to engage with different distribution partners. And the reason that we're now able to do that is because of some really wonderful breakthroughs that Victoria and our scientific team have achieved in implementing a process to freeze dry the microbes through a process called lyophilization, which Victoria can speak to more in depth, but essentially involves controlling both the temperature and the pressure surrounding the microbial consortia, such that you can freeze off the water without the cells exploding. That allows us to provide a powder form of our product, which is extremely dense and efficient. It's easy to ship, which is another great benefit, and great from an environmental perspective as well, to not have to move that water around. But then once it arrives to the farmer, they just have to mix in water, and they're ready to use it. But it's shelf stable for a much longer period of time. So that was a really important milestone for us to achieve, to now sort of open up these additional pathways with more distribution opportunities. And from our perspective, being comfortable that working with soil companies and or composting companies, that they would have a methodology in mind to ensure that the sort of life, the value created by these symbiotic relationships with the microbes, that's not sort of lost in the manufacturing distribution process.
Victoria, I can see where this is a very exciting and stimulating project for you to be working on or career. I related to your earlier comment that while academic research and activity is absolutely essential to the process, it's fairly slow. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you just want to have an effect on the commercial world. Mm-hmm. And so I relate to how you're operating. I started out in the academic world and then chose to return to private sector. And there are more and more PhDs now operating in the private sector. I'd say there might be more in the private sector now than in the academic community because there's been such consolidation of research programs.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. And it's great to bring in the knowledge building focus of the academic mindset into the private sector. It's just great to have more people working on more things and trying to do science in a rigorous and accessible way. That's something that we're really passionate about at MEO.
Good for you guys. Charles, as you were describing the new process that Victoria has been researching and developing, you brought to mind this winter my task for my mountain climbing and backpacking excursions. My task is to learn how to dehydrate food so that I can make my own dehydrated meals. So as you're describing the process, Charles, I'm thinking about yesterday rehydrating some lobster mac and cheese and tweaking the recipe so that I can eat what I want when I'm up in my tent. It's not only is a plant to plant, but some of these processes, the biological world is the same regardless of where we aim it. This is really a fascinating conversation.
I have one more question about the field application. If you're applying it to the fields with the residuals, does that reduce the labor needed in the field because you just apply it and lots is done? Or
yes, we are very conscious of, you know, kind of the all the resources that go into cultivation and you know, the one of the biggest kind of value adds with regen are those efficiency gains where you don't need to have such constant maintenance to make sure that your residuals are breaking down in a way that they will become extremely useful. So absolutely, Michelle, that is definitely a big part of the equation.
Thank you.
That's a great question, Michelle. And it brings to mind, now, Victoria, I'm going to aim this one at you. In my youth days on a family truck farm, tomatoes was our main row crop. Mm-hmm. And we were taught back then to remove the dead plant material from the field so that any pathogens wouldn't remain. So talk to that point a bit. As we apply regen and break down, let's say, a tomato biomass.
Yeah, absolutely. Pathogens in the field are, of course, incredibly important. They amount to so much crop loss, and many of them overwinter, which is, of course, the kind of worst-case scenario for some growers because they stay in the soil. So when we developed regen, we were awarded a grant from the National Science Foundation to work on that, and part of that grant was that we got to collaborate with scientists at the University of Vermont, a really wonderful scientist, Dr. Debonair, and her graduate student, Noah Olson. And so they did a lot of work to kind of independently verify our process. And part of that work was looking at the ability of the recycled biomass to suppress pathogens. So they got some really great results showing that the recycled biomass, once cured, could suppress the pathogens. We still need to do a lot of work around that before we can make any sort of claims around the value it could provide from that type of area. And of course, once you start talking about pathogen suppression, then you are a pesticide, and that comes with all sorts of other considerations, regulatory predominantly. So that's an incredibly important aspect of when you're thinking about recycling biomass. And I think there's some good signs of our product, but can't make any guarantees around that at the moment.
Yes, we'll point you towards that paper and say that we're very excited about that data. But as Victoria said, the language that we use to describe it is something that we need to be mindful of. Mm-hmm. But reason to be excited.
Okay, let me wind down my questioning and bring in the world of hydroponic edible crop production. Most of my research is currently in this realm, and about half of my research in this area, Victoria, is with biostimulants, where manufacturers or various companies come and say, gee, we've proven this to work in corn and soybeans. Now we're interested in the hydroponic environment. Mm-hmm. So speak to that a bit. Both of you are nodding. so that I know that it's been part of your conversations. Where are you with this arena?
Yeah, it's an incredibly important arena. Of course, we tend to think about our root product more when we think about hydroponic solutions. With propagation and cutting, we see some really nice results of generating those roots in this hydroponic situations pretty readily. And we're hoping to start researching more traditional crops, in particular leafy greens and tomatoes. But it's an incredibly important area to have products that work in. And the unfortunate reality of biostimulants and microbial products is that I think often a lot more of a product is promised than is actually provided. And that is, of course, the thing that we want to avoid at all costs, being a really science-driven company.
To that point, Victoria, I and colleagues working in the arena of the hydroponic side, one of the objectives is to help explain why grower A might succeed with product XYZ and down the street, grower B may not succeed with it. And again, we're circling back to our opening premise that we're understanding more about Mother Nature and the biological world. And we know the answer is in there, and we just need to expand our knowledge base, build it, learn more. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. Absolutely. And that is something that we think about a lot, too, because we developed our products in our lab in Vermont, and then we send our product to a grower in a different state, and their water's different, their soil is different, even a few inches down a field, the soil can be different. And all of these things can have an impact on a plant. So understanding that better is really important and a fun challenge.
And Charles, my last question. So you guys are both in Vermont, you're located in Vermont?
I split time between Vermont and New York. My wife is a doctor in New York, so in New York at the moment, but our science production teams and facility is in Vermont.
Cool. So Michelle and I are both down here in greater Boston area. I'm in Andover. So if you're ever down I-93 heading to Boston, please rattle my cage, stop in.
Absolutely. We'd love that. We'd love that.
That would be fun.
Yeah, would be wonderful to meet in person. And you know, one thing that I know Victoria and I both wanted to note is that we, you know, we really appreciate your podcast and kind of the way that you are, I think, very effectively connecting sort of academic sciences, economics, and research with the very practical business realities of growers. That's something that we, you know, really emphasize as well in wanting to, you know, make academic research more accessible and also to learn from the experiential knowledge that's out there and is so important, you know, in terms of people who have been cultivating for a very long time. They know a ton and they may use different terms than a research scientist might, but there's a lot that both communities can learn from one another. And so bridging that gap is something that's really important to us. And we very much see the two of you doing that as well with your podcast. So we wanted to call that out.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. It's nice to meet up with people that think similarly or, you know, have some principles that are share principles. Mm-hmm. So that's really cool.
Rounding it out, where can our listeners find you and more information about yourselves, your company, your products?
Absolutely. So our website is imio.co, imio.co. We like to say the .co is for co-culture for our microbes. We're also on Instagram, same handle actually, imio.co, and we also share science content there as well.
Wonderful. And we will include some of the resources you mentioned in the show notes so that people have that readily available. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Grower and the Economist. If you enjoyed the episode, please rate it wherever you listen to podcasts. It helps us get discovered by new listeners. If you have questions, concerns, or would like to suggest a podcast topic, please email me at michelle@stratagerm.com. I love hearing from you. Until next time.